Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Egg Chasers. It's the Egg Chasers Rugby Podcast, the podcast about rugby that doesn't take itself or the game too seriously, back for a second episode of this week. And this is, these are going to become a thing in this little strange, weird little period we're in right now. We're going to celebrate rugby. We're going to use the time we might have to look at some of the greatest games of all time, get you to watch it, give us your thoughts. We can reminisce, we can get nostalgic, we can compare the rugby now to rugby
Hello,
then.
Tim.
And all sorts of other things.
Hello, Tim.
As a result. And this week's game, we asked you to watch, and thank you for doing so. Or if you didn't, you could hit pause now, go and watch it on YouTube. You'll find the link on our Twitter account, Rugby Podcast on Twitter. It's New Zealand versus France, the 1999 Rugby World Cup semi-final at Twickenham. How much did you enjoy watching this?
My favourite game of all time.
What a game.
All time.
What a game. So I think we've got to go into the positives and the negatives, but focusing on the positives.
Yeah, let's go with the positives, because there's so many negatives which I've discovered about this game. It's kind of like never meet your hero kind of thing, isn't it?
But the positives, I mean, the tries, some of the tries, the French back three going forward, absolutely incredible. Dominici was just sensational. Jonah Lomu as well, and Jonah Lomu and Wilson and Cullen, when New Zealand could bring them into the game, were just unreal. But New Zealand couldn't bring them into the game very frequently. The attacking positivity and dynamism of those teams were incredible. The defensive structure and some of the breakdown work and some of the refereeing, a few things maybe to be questioned on some of those.
So when I watched this game, I would have been playing fifth form rugby, okay? So that weird sort of stage in school where you qualify for the senior team, the sixth form rugby, but you're in fifth form. So you don't really know what's going on. And actually, when I watched this game back, I seem to remember most of it. And I was thinking to myself, as far as I'm concerned, throughout my whole rugby playing life, rugby has always looked like this. What we were watching looked sort of like rugby. But if you go back even, 5 years maybe? It looks nothing like it. And I wonder when that tipping point was.
Professionalism. So 1994, 95, there's a big difference. Partly because of lineouts.
Yeah, the lineouts are the big one, aren't they?
Although still, even though they had lifting by this point, which they hadn't had in the early 90s, like you say, it changed in the mid-90s. The lifting was still bloody dreadful.
Do you remember what... But were you watching? And I'm not saying you're wrong, Tim. I'm just saying... do you know what the rules were between full lifting and then not lifting? So there's like an interim period, wasn't there? So the reason I didn't know about this is because I used to play in the back. So I used to be a winger until I was 24. So I never really paid attention. But you might have been watching a game where you were allowed to jump, you weren't allowed to lift, but you weren't allowed to support, whatever the hell that means.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was no pre-binding allowed.
What were the rules? I don't know. I never played under those laws.
Well, so I think about this sort of this point by 99 people were lifting, but it was kind of mainly on the shorts. I mean, there was that period when it first came in when people were doing they were doing lifting like what's the exercise where you get a bar and you lift it up under your chin with your elbows up high?
Upright
row.
Upright row. It was like people were lifting on the back of a pair of shorts like it was an upright row.
The techniques you see, they make you want to cry.
In this game, with the lineouts, the accuracy rate of the lineout was awful. And that's to your point, Tim, that it's while they have been lifting for a few years, they've not got it down to a fine art at this stage.
Ibanez, right? Actually, we'll save this for the negatives. But like, how anyone let him play international rugby throwing like that was beyond me.
Well, the one-arm throw, that was how it used to be done.
It's just been, but I mean, they were full-time professionals. Someone must have had a look at that and go, hang on a minute, wait there. There's something else that we can do here. I mean, maybe I'm looking at it with the benefit of hindsight. I must be, mustn't I? But you can't get away with that.
Well, you just mentioned Ibanez, and that was the first thing that struck me when the team sheets came up. The amount of leadership, and only looking back with hindsight, look at the number of people that have gone all the way up in French rugby, in clubs and in the national team. Fabien Galthié was the scrum half. Raphael Ibanez, the hooker.
Well, I don't know if you count it as a success, but Mark Lievremont.
Mark Lievremont, yeah. was the blind side. Ugo Mola was a replacement. He came on the wing. The Toulouse.
Yeah.
Boss. Fabien Palouse, Abdel Benazi. There was all these names. It was so many great names.
Wasn't Fabien Palouse at Toulouse for a little while? I mean, not player, as a coach for a while.
May well have been. I don't remember.
Is he not? He might even be there now. I really don't know. I'd have to check.
But it was an amazing little crop of
Do you ever think of Fabien Palouse as the French Martin Johnson?
Yeah, I do a little bit.
I 100% see that. I like the violence, the aggression. Maybe more violence, actually.
And similar periods as well.
Yeah.
He's probably played a bit longer than... He's probably a few years younger, isn't he, than Johnson?
I don't know, but they're always opposing captains. He was my out-and-out favourite player growing up. Out-and-out favourite. Loved him.
Also, when I was looking at the team sheets, I noticed that I'm wondering, when did the replacement numbers get standardised? Because I didn't clock until they started coming on the second half. The replacement numbers were like 16 was like the back three back replacement, and 21 was the tight head props.
So I hate to admit this.
When did that flip around?
Well, I have
no idea.
I hate to admit this because I should, you know, being a rugby podcast, I should know it. I have no idea what number replacements were.
What, even
it's
now?
So,
even
it's now? So simple.
Yeah, I've never paid any attention to it. I know Mike Phillips used to wear 21, maybe. Yeah,
that's the standardised scrum half replacement shirt.
Yeah, so that's the only reason. The only reason I know scrum halves wear 21 is because I've got Mike Phillips burned in my mind wearing a red 21.
But only since 2012, because before that they would have been number 20, because before 2012. You only had one prop on the bench.
Yeah, but some teams, if I got this right, don't they have the replacement tight head as the highest number?
So some French teams do that. Toulon do that.
Yeah, I only know that because you told me once.
Yeah, from when they brought in the extra, the third from the replacement.
I quite like that.
Yeah, I can see. Although it does, it perfectly makes sense because most teams have 16, 17, 18, with 16 being your hooker replacement, 17 being your loose head, and 18 being your tight head. And then 19 would be...
The hooker's the first replacement?
Yeah.
That's nuts.
It should really be loose head 16, hooker 17, tight
head
18.
Absolutely it should. That is ridiculous. Sorry, Karen.
That is tradition.
Well, not for that long, though. It's tradition, but I don't know when it changed because, as I say, back here, 16 was Daryl Gibson for New Zealand and Ugo Mola for France, and both their tight head props were wearing 21.
So, Daryl Gibson, Oh, so I'm thinking of Jonathan Gibbs. Darryl Gibson is coaching somewhere, though, isn't he? Darryl Gibson coached the Waratahs, and then he came to France. But I don't know where he is now. He definitely coached the Waratahs, 1,000,000%.
So I'll take your word for it. I have no idea.
So that's another name for your pantheon of, well, people that made it to the top.
Coach Waratahs until 2019. That's about all I've got from him.
Is he not in France somewhere? Sure, he's an attack coach for someone.
Not from his. So he walked away from the Waratahs in June 2019. Nothing after that. From a very, very quick search.
Yeah.
Sorry, go on, Jay.
I was going to say, did you notice that they had one? Hang on. I'm going to embarrass myself here. Zinzan Brook did not play eight in this game, did he?
No.
But he did play.
Did he?
Yes.
He's in the second row, wasn't he?
I thought so.
No, that was Robin Brook, wasn't it?
I think it's Zinzan.
Was it Robin? Was it the other one?
Think it was Zinzan.
So I'm looking at the team sheet here from a BBC article
that's no guarantee it's right.
Well, so
you made me doubt myself even more now.
This does list Zinzan Brook in the second row.
I can't believe I thought it was Robin Brook.
But no, it might be Robin Brook because it also lists Jason Kelleher playing scrum half. There isn't a rugby player called Jason Kelleher.
The worst part is now, I've actually forgot Kelleher's first name.
Byron.
Byron,
thank you.
Byron.
Byron Kelleher. Yeah, you're right.
If we're talking positives for a second, JB will probably see this as a negative, but so many of the comments we've got, David Paul, it was the first thing he mentioned. Damien Stewart, first thing he mentioned. Walter Ludwig III, by the way. We have some fine listeners.
Don't we just?
Walter Ludwig III, hello. He is a professor. He's an author. And he works in South Asian security and insurgency and US foreign policy. He's a listener.
Nice.
Yeah, I think I followed him back.
We have some fine people. Ben Smart, another fine person. But everybody's mentioning the speed at which the scrums and lineouts happen, particularly the scrums.
Yeah.
With zero resets. Even though they're kind of, they look a bit shambolic the way they very quickly come together. No reset scrums.
The whole set piece, right? And we're going to get in. In fact, let's just get into this now. The set piece really reflects the whole of the game, which is it is so threadbare on quality. I know that sounds awful, but it really is. I mean, you seem to get players which are just good at like a handful of things. I'm thinking what your brother would think of these lineouts and scrums. That's what I'm thinking. He'd be disgusted.
But as a spectacle, if you're looking at it for a restart of play, they're great. Because
They're not great.
Very, very quickly gives you a restart and some attacking ball.
I'm sorry. The lineouts in particular. I mean, the lineouts don't give you any attacking ball. It's a complete lottery. Yeah.
The lineouts were a lottery.
A modern lineout now is a mixture of weightlifting and synchronized swimming. It is one of the finest things that humans can put together. So the lineouts are definitely not better than the current modern lineouts.
I'd agree with that. Lineouts are worse. Scrums,
I'd agree with that.
Better.
They're not better. A well-executed scrum now. I mean, yes, you can get bad ones where, as we've all pointed out, it takes them 2 minutes to set up and they're cleaning their boots and whatnot. And yeah, not great at all.
It does highlight.
But it really works wonderfully. Does.
No, yeah, I get it. But it has highlight. Watching this game from 1999, if that does not, I mean, everyone was saying it already. The scrum resets are taking too long. This is ridiculous. But it's just magnified and hugely when you go back and watch 99. And we have sacrificed entertainment on the altar of safety. And it's gone too.
Yeah. And it is a safety thing. And the weird thing about the safety issue is it's made it less safe. Because if I mean, you know, you think about the obvious thing, which is how do we make scrum stay up because we're causing too many injuries? Well, obviously, we make sure the players can clean their boots. Okay, so you let them clean their boots so they can get their purchase. That sounds logical. But then before you know it, you can have bigger guys who need to be as fit. You can get a little rest in. You know, they can all get good purchase now so they become more powerful.
The front row get comfy and then the second rows go down. And only when the second rows are comfy as well, then the back rows go down.
Yeah. I mean, the amount of power that you can generate in a scrum now is frighteningly large compared to what you could do then.
Do you not think part of it is the amount of breaks they have means that rugby can have bigger and bigger guys because they don't need the aerobic capacity because they get a... I don't know.
They work so hard. I think that has been mitigated somewhat. I will say this, though. You know, if you've made your crust as a premiership forward, particularly a tight five, in recent years, and now you're in the administration of the game, and what you've done throughout your whole career is sort of modern scrummaging, where you take a lot of pride in how you set up and how you do this, that, and the other. It's very hard for you to rewrite the rules to take away the thing that you did well.
Yeah.
You know, these institutions are sort of built.
I do think there is a move towards speeding up the game and speeding up ball in play time. And every year, the ball in play time is increasing. So that there's an objective of that. And that will have the like secondary intended consequence of if you've got more ball in play time and the game is faster, you're going to have players being a bit fitter and being a bit leaner, which...
And taking their times to scrum.
Well, or taking their times to scrum, which is... So that bit is like, it contradicts... speeding up the game, because why speed up the game if you can then just slow it down for 2 minutes so all the props can get their breath back?
I think James Sale put it quite well. He tweeted us at Rugby Podcast and he said, he emailed us, I beg your pardon, and he said the scrums were mostly a way to restart the game, and I think that's what's it's now teams are targeting it as a penalty opportunity. A way to restart the game.
Yeah, absolutely, they are. I don't mind that though. I like the combative nature of it. I like the psychology of making them give up a penalty. Love it.
Scrums may be better. Lineouts are definitely worse.
Oh, lineouts were shambolic, but it was almost so bad it was good.
What about backs moves?
I think the backs moves, when they used them, were pretty good at times. They kicked a lot more, and they kicked seemingly aimlessly, but the back three seemed to be so disjointed on both teams that the aimless kicks were turned into very good kicks. Which I'm sure is more because the back three were totally out of position than it was a really intelligent thought through kick.
People are
sure, I'm certain of it.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Phil. So people are not going to like this next comment. Jonah Lomu did not impress me at all.
His two tries were unbelievable.
Oh, his tries were ridiculous. Imagine Jonah Lomu in fantasy rugby draft, defenders beaten.
Yeah,
imagine breaks. It's ridiculous.
Imagine fantasy rugby draft had a section. Out of position horribly, -6 points every time. He just doesn't care about dropping back into position. He just didn't care. And the Mason was looking up at Will, going, right, I think I'll put the ball there, I'll put the ball there. Every time it was hitting grass. And I was like, it's actually jarring because I watch so much modern rugby. You never see that. You assume there's going to be four back or three back or two back or...
What Jonah Lomu did was incredible because we recognise and we spot the defenders beaten stats and stuff for a game because that's a statistic. Bearing in mind, just in the cause of scoring two tries, let alone the other 79 minutes, Jonah Lomu beat 13 defenders in those just in those two tries alone.
Most of it, right, was psychological warfare. I mean, the French could not get out of his way quick enough.
Well, I mean, you've really got to put defenders in air quotes for some of those. There was a few people who did not want to be involved in that at all.
Yeah, like even smaller modern players would not have got caught like the French did. I think Cheslin Colby does a good job of shepherding Jonah Lomu into touch. I really do. And Another thing which I found fascinating was how much kicking there was.
Yeah, but it was successful because the teams were so badly set up defensively.
Yeah, well, this leads me to my next point, right, which is there was not kicking because they just kicked back in the olden days, although maybe they did when you watch some of the England games, and that seems to be... England seemed to kick for the sake of kicking. Now, France seems to do it quite intelligently, but the thought I had, and I discussed this with Phil, is if there was a man or two men of Owen Farrell and George Ford's capabilities, not their physical prowess, let's just say they were in exactly the same bodies as the guys on TV that we watched from the 99 semis.
Yeah.
They would have made mincemeat out of that New Zealand back three. Just the quality of skills and kicking is just off the charts. If anything, France didn't kick enough.
Yeah, I tend to agree that, and they didn't kick particularly intelligently, but they were successful because New Zealand was so poor positionally.
Yeah, rucks as well. The amount of manpower, I mean, resourcing the ruck is a big deal in 1999.
Well, so if the rucks, so I thought there was some really interesting observations in terms of the referee and decisions and how they treated offences differently to how we do today.
Yeah. So
in the first 10 minutes, there were four or five offsides that were penalised, like that were all very marginal offsides, but referee penalised them and blew up penalty kick at sticks that massively slowed the game down. There was also, at the rucks, when a defender got his hands on the ball, the ref would blow after half a second. The ref would give as half a second. It was so fast. And that meant that the attackers coming to clean out were flying in left, right and centre. No one was finding. People going on off their feet. They're flying in from all angles and the ref's letting all that go. It's so different to how it's refereed now. It's like a totally different sport.
And those French boys, Benazie, Pelouse, and Lee Evremont, oh my, they were, Amagna, were just flying in.
Ruck hitters. Yeah. They love to hit rucks.
Yeah, massively.
So the few interesting things there. One, there didn't seem to be much thought into how many people they should put into rucks, because presumably the forwards weren't in any sort of shape whatsoever. And I don't mean physical shape. I mean as in like team structure. They're not doing any of that. They're just going around the corner and hitting every ruck that they can put. In fact, if anything, you know, when you think about work rate nowadays, it's achievable work rate. Hit every other ruck, or hit rucks in this area, and then maybe someone like Dane Coles will hit it out wide. You know, there's a certain pattern of where you work. It looked to me as if the French forwards and the New Zealand forwards, for that matter, were just hitting. They were working as hard as they could. There was no rhyme or reason to what they were hitting. They were just hitting everything.
Well, there were definitely occasions where there's rooks. The ball is already out of the ruck, and there are still players hitting. There are still forwards hitting the ruck because it is the nearest thing. It's like the nearest objective for them to achieve.
Yeah. So there was that. And then there's the weird thing about, I'm not even sure how you get a turnover back in the day, because you're not allowed to interfere with the ruck. Until George Smith was born, no one was allowed to touch any balls in the ruck. Am I right?
No, they were, but the referee would just blow up so quickly for the defender's hands-on, but not let the attackers just fly in from every single angle off the feet.
Yeah.
All over the place, no binding. So just a bit weird, just very differently refereed.
Outside of Olivier Mania, I'm not entirely sure the French forwards could carry a ball.
Mania was good.
Mania was so
excellent.
Good.
And for the Bernard Salles try towards the end,
he kicked through, didn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, when he hacks through and he's off. Mania is rapid. He's
absolutely rapid.
So Piers Dixon got in touch and said, what an absolute pleasure it was watching that game. And he's highlighted some things you don't see anymore. We've already touched on one of them, quick scrums, with hardly any resets. Secondly, and this is the one I thought I'd mention. Oh, actually, he says Scottish referees. And he's right. I can't think of another Scottish ref.
Someone told me a few months ago that the Celtic nations had stopped training refs effectively. Like very few were coming through. I don't know where I got that from, or if that's true. But you are right. I don't know of any Scottish refs.
Yeah.
And someone else mentioned, I'll try and give them credit, but it was weirdly, someone said this and I thought it was bang on. It was weirdly nice. Oh yeah, here we go. James Sale again. He weirdly enjoyed not hearing the ref and him being a bit of an enigma. There was no ref mic at this point. And it is a brilliant insight we get, but is there an argument that by hearing the ref and hearing the decisions, that almost invites the disagreeing with the call, rather than what it was back in 99, which is right or wrong, refs made the decision, next play.
But do you know, the problem with the ref, actually, if I remember this correctly, isn't there a decision right at the start which looks like a French try, but is disallowed?
I can't remember.
Right at the start, something happens. Or was it a New Zealand try? Oh,
yes. No, yeah. They touch it down. There's a kick through and New Zealand touch it down. But it looks like he might have, the commentators were saying, did he knock it over the line, so it should have been a 5-metre scrum?
That's right. And now I'm trying to remember, okay. Did the ref nail that, or did he get it horribly wrong?
I don't know, but one of the commentators said, oh, you know, this might be another time where we start talking about needing a video referee.
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure it looks like, right at the start, it looks like, oh, what the hell? What was the decision?
I think it was Cullen touched it down. And it was a 22 dropout, and it maybe should have been a 5-metre scrum to France.
Did Cullen play?
Yeah, he played 13. Cullen,
well, he played 13. So
yes,
weirdly,
of course he did. Yes.
So New Zealand usually had Umanga at 13, Wilson at 14, Cullen at 15, but they rejigged it for this game and put Umanga on the wing, Wilson at 15, and Cullen at 13.
No. Umanga used to always play on the wing. Only slightly later on in his career did he move to 13. So I don't think he'd move. Yeah, I don't think he'd made the move to 13 yet.
Well, Wilson was class anyway.
Wilson looked like a guy who could play today.
Yeah, that's a fair shout.
100, yeah. Like the explosivity he has, the way he moves his body. Yeah, I didn't realise he was that good actually. Because I always got caught up with his hair. His hair didn't, like, his hair never looked like it belonged on someone who was really good at sport.
Yeah,
you have to be really good to keep Christian Cullen out of a 15 jersey.
Yeah.
Pretty good. Or make him move positions.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, Cullen. Yeah, so that's what I was going to say. Like, if I was picking that team, with the benefit of hindsight and how all these guys' careers worked out, I'd put Umanga at 13, Wilson on the wing, and Cullen at fullback. What am I missing? Tell me I'm wrong. Tell me I'm mental.
No, exactly. Well, that's what I assumed was the norm. But I was like, why have they done it like that? But yeah.
Yeah, I assume, same as Jay, that this was earlier on in Tanner Umaga's career, and he was actually playing wing at that point in time.
Yeah,
that might be wrong.
Do you know who the New Zealand 12 was?
Jeremiah.
Don't know him. I literally don't know.
No, I'd never really heard of him.
Phil?
No, me neither.
Oh, good. I'm good. I'm not alone then.
But on the referee front, he was wearing a Mizuno jersey. That's something you don't see anymore as well.
Yeah,
it was a horrible kit, horrible ref kit.
I was in, it's been a long time since I've been to Six Nations. Do you know when you know someone's faking?
Go on.
Go on, qualify this statement. I don't know what you're talking about.
So I went to the Six Nations with my dear friend Bryn Williams a long, long time ago now. Good
friend of the pod, standing presenter, Bryn Williams.
Standing presenter, Bryn Williams, right? And to get a pint, what we'd do, in fact, to get several pints, and a whole afternoon's worth of pints, actually, what we'd do is we'd go to the Cardiff Blues Ground, which is next door to the Millennium Stadium, and go drinking there. And the Welsh rugby fan, for the most part, is, well, they're quite passionate. They all wear their Welsh jerseys. I was coming down the stairs in the Cardiff Blues bar, and on the stairs passing me was a guy, get this for a get-up, he was wearing a referee's top from Super League.
What?
Yeah, a Super League referee's top. That's the guy who said, yeah, do you want to come to rugby? Oh, I don't really know much about rugby. He's asked his mate from Wigan if he has any spare rugby tops, and he's been given a rugby league A Super League ref's top to go and watch Wales France.
Nice.
Oh, dear me.
Let me point out something else that you saw in this game that you don't see anymore. But this would have been a staple of all of us growing up at whatever level of rugby. A 10-12 switch off first phase.
Thank you. I wanted to mention that. Yeah, that has no place in any professional game. Do you think...
Phil, you played in a back line. Well, you played in a back line in your early days as well, Jay. Did you have very simple moves? I remember, like, Colts rugby, it was knife, fork, spoon. Knife was a pop, the switch with the 10-12 switch. Fork was dummy switch, pop to 13. And then spoon DSP. Was dummy switch, give it to 15 coming into the line.
Switchy. Yeah,
the only three moves that they had off any set piece.
What was your...
Every team had a Rangi. Yeah, you're right.
And Far East.
Rangi very, very, very rarely worked.
It'd be called Sexton now.
Yeah. What was a DSP called by your Spanish centre friend, Phil? It's ridiculous. Lost it. It's like someone put it into Google Translate and it came out wrong.
Oh, I can't remember.
Slicey miss or something.
Yeah. I can't even remember. Good old Carlos.
Yeah, slicey miss.
But in 1999, a switch off from 10 to 12 off of a scrum was standard.
Well, doesn't it just show you, though, like how things have evolved and how they've kind of thought things through? The idea of burning your 10, as in using him up in a move like that, and your 12. Imagine your Gloucester, for instance, right? Just wasting Danny Cipriani giving Mark Atkinson a switch. No. You move your best playmaker as far away from that action as you possibly can. And then you get your 12 to be the playmaker.
Yeah.
And then you play immediately off next phase. Like, and that's kind of, it sort of links in, doesn't it, to how they were rucking. Like, everyone works in their own way as hard as they can. There's no real structure. So therefore, there's no structure. You don't need a launch play.
Yeah.
Just go for it, boys. Off you go.
On the flip side, the one thing that was amazing about this game, and you don't see as much anymore, that the Piers Dixon again pointed this one out, which I totally agree with the way he put it, the lost art of simply drawing the defender and giving a pass.
I don't know. Maybe. Yeah, I think there's some romance in that. Can you remember the last time? Yeah, I can actually. I'm talking nonsense. I was going to say, do you remember the last time that a 2-on-1 has been clearly butchered? Yes, I do. But yeah, I'm going to give modern players a little more credit.
In the modern game, there is a kind of, and I understand it, there's almost like a risk management element to everything. And actually, they've sort of crunched the numbers with some auditor and actually just keep hold of the ball and don't pass it. Take contact.
Yeah. There's a few things in there. There are definitely some areas of this game which are so far inferior to the modern game, it's hard to watch. But you can't get over the fact that it's a far more romantic game and a far more enjoyable game.
Now, on that side of things, the difference from this game to today, did either of you watch the World Rugby 1991 England versus France that was shown on Saturday afternoon?
No, I wanted to, though.
Yeah, I did.
From the World Cup.
I remember that game so vividly.
So I don't remember that game at all at the time. It was too early for me. But, I mean, it was an unbelievable game to watch for lots of reasons. Again, some positive and some negative. But the passion and the brutality in that game were almost unparalleled.
Yeah.
To what you see now, like French players crying during the anthems, and everyone, like both teams, so many players nearly losing their cool so many times.
And the noise of the crowd reflected it as well.
Yeah.
The atmosphere was incredible.
Yeah.
That was part of the France, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So it was the 99 World Cup, which was technically hosted by Wales for the Millennium Stadium, but it was played across all the different countries. So England's knockout games, one was played at Parc des Princes, one was played at Murrayfield, and one was played at Twickenham.
Were they, Were they the away team in the Twickenham game?
I don't know.
Because they have been the away team in Twickenham. No, they haven't. I'll tell you what it was. I think Wales were the away team in the Millennium Stadium against England.
Ah.
Maybe. No, because... No, that can't be it, because they beat them.
Oh, maybe they did. Maybe... Oh, I don't know.
Wales were definitely the away team in the Millennium.
But anyway, in that game, so past the passion and the brutality, there was almost no rugby played in it whatsoever, which felt like a deliberate game plan from England. England had a scrum on the 22. They actually had multiple scrums and lineouts on the 22, which were perfect attacking ball. And all they did was pass the ball to Rob Andrew, who put the ball up as high as possible so it landed just out on the 5 metre line of the, so deep inside the French 22. Rather than a passing move, just boot it in the air and have a 15-man chase. So that was it.
They did the Glanville and...
No, it was Carlin and Guscott.
It was Carlin and Guscott, wasn't it? I'm thinking of other games. I've been looking ahead to other games we could potentially watch. I'm getting all confused. Yeah, Carlin and Guscott, that's right.
So... Yeah. That strategy is very simple in terms of its conception and in terms of the execution for Rob Andrew. Where it is phenomenally difficult, and I've experienced this myself, is actually keeping everyone on board with it, because you can kick the ball three or four times, maybe 10 minutes goes by.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
That you're worried about has been nullified because it's a great leveler, and then you relax and you start to play and you get beaten up because you realise you were only kicking the ball because you didn't think you were as good as them, and you were absolutely right. And as soon as you stop, you then start to get a good beating, as Argentina found out right at the end of the 2003 World Cup. No?
2007.
2007, yeah. It's a lot of discipline on that.
The atmosphere in that 91 game, and in our game that we're talking about, the 99 game, the atmosphere of just the crowd and everything was incredible. And it did make me think, are we sacrificing the entertainment of our game a little bit? And how could we, you know, because I can't remember the last time I was in a stadium that was making that kind of noise that you could feel was coming off the screen, even on a grainy YouTube video.
Yeah, they did. I don't know. Do you think it's the way it's filmed as well, though, Tim? Do you think there's better audio from? Because at the moment we are watching games, and you mentioned before that the ref is mic'd up, and we're trying to get all this information, and the broadcast quality is much better now. But you also get a lot more things. Back in the day, maybe the only thing they could pipe onto your TV was the crowd noise.
It could also be that what we're picking are some of the most important and best games of all time, comparing it to an average game that we see at the moment.
Yeah, because Tim, you'll remember me and you being at the Millennium Stadium.
Oh, wow. Five years ago. That was something else. The 15-minute Wales goal line stand against Ireland.
Yeah, in the Six Nations. The atmosphere in there was incredible, absolutely incredible. Probably the best atmosphere I've ever seen in a sporting event live. Same. And that wasn't one of these unbelievable flowing.
Yeah, that's fair.
The Millennium Stadium is an unbelievable venue, to be fair.
Best venue to watch sport at. Yeah,
it's superb, isn't it?
I wonder if it's something like the broadcaster used to do, which they don't do anymore because they're more interested in the nuance of the game, what the ref is saying, and whatnot.
Possibly. Yeah.
Do you think that the passion Yeah, I'd say the passion of rugby has been replaced by a seriousness now. So, whereas before you could lose and it's all very passionate and you'd be very upset and devastated and all the rest of it, that'd be one thing. But now it feels like the stakes are higher, but there's more like a professional pressure. Like if you lose, it is serious. Heads will roll. No one's going to scream and shout, but it is much, much more serious.
I don't know, because there's also now the different dynamic, which is you can lose, but you're still going to take home your 26 grand a game or your £500,000 a year salary. Maybe less 25% this year. But I don't know. Certainly to 1991 and even 1999, because it was only just outside professionalism in 1999.
Well,
wasn't what it is now.
Well, have you boys seen the F1 docs on Netflix?
No, I've got that. That's next.
Oh my God, they're so good. First of all, they are so good. But what they really do is they convey... I mean, like F1 is a really good example of what professional seriousness is all about. So, you know, they're not passionate about their cars winning. They want them to win. But they know if they get it wrong, that is their job. So it's a lot more... like there's a lot more pressure and tension involved because they could get fired. And there's a lot of money involved. Whereas if they were just a bunch of amateurs, they'd be very passionate about doing it. And you know, if they lose, that's dreadful for that day. But it's not the same impact. And actually, Phil, the fact there is so much money in it kind of emphasizes that point. It's a serious business.
So a key distinction there, and I don't know if this is the distinction, but a key distinction that you just hinted at was if they don't perform, they lose their job.
Yeah.
Which is, so in rugby, now, if you continually play terribly, you're not going to get another contract.
No,
and there's not that immediate like precipice.
Just out of interest, have you mentioned that's Luther Burrell?
What?
Timon Harrison. You mentioned it to them.
Yeah, but they would still go back on their £300,000 a year Northampton contract.
Yeah, fair.
They just don't get the 20 extra 26 grand or 25 grand bonus.
Yeah, the extra £200,000 a year from England.
And I think thinking about the romance of this, the what it means to the players is no less when it comes to World Cups. We're pulling on the international jersey. There's tears rolling down the cheeks. No England player will be thinking about the 25 grand when they're running out onto the Twitter.
Well, Nick Easter did.
Ben Teo did.
Ben Teo definitely did.
Well, what did Nick used to say? Well, there's 10 grand down the toilet. love that so much.
But back to this game, one thing we sort of, you can get romantic and think, oh, the values were so much better, and in some respects they were. There was no chops in at the ref, none. People just, there was a penalty, they just walked back 10 metres, and I did quite like watching that. Equally, The French were amazing, the amount that they were booing Andrew Mertens every time he went to take a penalty kick. Yeah.
You got to.
Yeah, exactly.
The French culture.
Yeah, exactly. Oh. We'd be missing something if the French didn't boo.
Oh, my God. I've got it on in the background now. And there's just been... So New Zealand make a break, go down in the French 22. And... one French player is trying to get the ball and four New Zealand players all dive in, no arms, straight off the feet to clear him out. Penalty New Zealand.
It is.
It's unbelievable.
It's absolute Wild West, isn't it?
I love a bit of ruck justice.
It's total Wild West, the rucks. Absolutely.
I loved it. I loved it. So one of the stats came up, and I'll see if you can guess. They had very few graphics back in the day, so they played the same graphics several times through the match.
Yeah.
The average pack weight in this match, what would you guess it was?
I think it is one. Go on.
You go, Jay. Because I think I saw it.
103 kilograms.
So I think I saw it. I think it was slightly over that, maybe 105 and 106.
They did it in stone, but it was 16 and a half stone. So you both.
Yeah, I remember watching it thinking, I'm big enough to play international rugby. Thank God.
But it's not that much smaller.
It's tiny.
No, it's not that much smaller like, what would the, what I reckon the average, the average, the average weight of a, the average weight of an international forward now is the average weight. If you average the whole pack, it's probably 17 and a half stone. You'd have props that are 18 or 19, but you'd have back rows that are 16.
Well, that's not, that's good
maths. There's not many back rows that are 16 these
days.
No,
you're right, actually. You're right, actually.
Maybe, I'm trying, who is a 16 stone back row? I mean, Sam Underhill?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Tom Curry?
No, he's massive, mate.
No, no, but he's so lean that he probably isn't much more. I don't think he's much. He won't be over 17 stone.
Well, Sam Underhill's 106, so he is over. He's over 16.
Okay, all right, fine.
What is 106? 16:10 is 106.
So yeah, he's approaching 17.
But these bunch of boys in this 99 game would not look as good in match fit tight jerseys.
No chance.
Bloody hell, Tom Curry's 99 kilograms according to this. No, he's not.
No way. That might be his weight at 18.
When he was 12.
He's a freak now.
He's unbelievably massive.
Yeah, there's no way he's 99 kilos.
This is broken. This phone's broken.
Did you notice that there was did you notice that there were yellow cards given in this, but they didn't go on?
Yeah. And all they say, that's a caution. What do they say?
Caution. He's got a caution for that.
Yeah, I did wonder what the old situation was with yellow cards.
It was for like a swinging arm high tackle as well. There you go, caution.
Straight red.
No sin bin. Like so many things would be. I mean, if a referee from now enforced the current rules in this game in 99, there would have been about seven players on each team left.
Oh, and even worse if they'd done it in the 1991 England-France game.
Oh, yeah.
In the first minute, the Heslop, I think it was, the England winger hits the fullback. I can't remember his name for some reason. The French fullback.
Castagnède?
No.
And who was it?
From 1991, the absolute class.
Blanco, Serge Blanco.
Serge Blanco, yeah. He hits him late after Blanco's marked the ball.
Oh, yeah. Knocks Blanco, himself out almost.
Well, he hits his head, but then he gets two punches in the head straight afterwards. He's laying prone. So one from the second row and one from the fullback.
Yeah.
He lays prone on the ground for 3 minutes. The ref has a stern talking to the French players.
Yeah.
No cards, no nothing. Brilliant. It's an England penalty. And the winger just gets up and plays on.
Like, yeah. No HIA.
There's for so many reasons. It's so, so different to how it is now.
It was amazing. But what I do like is the fact the commentators were, and it happened in the 99 game, this game we're talking about, France, New Zealand. There's so many things that happen where the commentators are like, oh, well, you know, that's just rugby right there, isn't it? Oh, nothing to see here. There's one point, Ibanez gets, Ibanez might have been the one that got a yellow card. I can't remember anyway. But basically, the commentator just says it in the way that you'd say, I'm just nipping to the kitchen to make a cup of tea. The commentator says, oh, Ibanez just dives in, leading with his head into the head of the opponent.
Oh, yeah. It's normal.
So, Tim, just a quick one for you. The average weight of the French pack last year was 120 kilograms.
Oh, my word. Okay, I'll take it all back.
Which is 19 stone, best part of
it. That's unbelievable.
Jesus.
The average weight of the packs at the moment is about 112.
Okay, so like 17, about 17 and a half.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a stone. So I'm saying in 21 years,
yeah,
like a stone of muscle mass is.
I wonder what they're going to look like in 21 years' time from now.
Wow. Frightening thought.
120 kilograms. Oh my word. A man. Anyway, sorry, boys, I interrupted you. What were we saying?
I'll move it on. Did we see, like, you've said some of his defensive frailties were there, but what I loved is that on the same field, we had Jonah Lomu and Christophe Dominici.
Yeah.
Yes.
Dominici was electric in this
game. Dominici is one of my favourite all-time players.
I mean, if you were in New Zealand, would you not have just, like, gone, Lomu, yeah, we'll put number 11 on your back, but just change wing straight after.
But it didn't. It actually didn't matter because the wing that he was that Lomu was against didn't want to tackle him either.
No.
So, but they just couldn't. They couldn't get him into the game as much as they wanted to. They couldn't get him or Cullen or Wilson into the game at all. When they did, the two opportunities that he had, he just ran through, round, past the French team and scored two very, very good tries. But they couldn't get the ball to him more than that for whatever reason.
The French comeback. So New Zealand were 24-10 up 10. Early in the second half.
Yes.
So any New Zealand side in a World Cup semi-final, 24-10, game over. France scored 33 unanswered 33, points.
33 points.
But they scored 26 points in 10 minutes.
It was incredible.
Which all kicked off with something else you don't see much anymore. Two drop goals.
Yeah.
Quick succession.
When you're down like that as well. It's a very bold tactic. I really, really, really like it. Just get the points however you can, restart and play on, rather than try and force the try. It worked perfectly. Really, really good.
And then that Dominici try, and it was an insane game.
Have I made this up? But there was a time, wasn't there, when Johnny Wilkinson, and I don't mean the World Cup final before anyone says anything, but he was regularly dropping goals just to make sure they got points as soon as they got into the 22, basically, to make sure they always had scoreboard pressure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have I actually made that up?
And in 99, it was quite a common thing because who's the South African fly?
Jannie De Beer?
De Beer, yeah.
Oh, no, Joost.
Was it?
No, you're thinking. The other one was he does Sky Sports now.
Scrum half. Tinus Delport is a winger.
No.
Delport played wing 15, didn't he?
So you're a South African scrum half?
No, fly half.
Fly half.
Oh,
fly
right. Half. Oh, I see.
He played the World Cup final and won it.
Oh.
It was Yanni De Beer.
He was the one that got the five drop goals against England.
Yeah.
That's exactly who I'm thinking of.
Oh, is it? And so you're not thinking of the guy who got the drop goal in the World Cup final, maybe? Or you got a few?
No, I'm thinking 99. It was Yanni De Beer. I'm just looking up. So he got six in the tournament, of which, is that right, that five of them were against England in 99?
Yeah. So a legend. So do you know where that idea came from? Because Yanni De Beer apparently wasn't particularly good at dropping goals. But that day he decided to. The reason they did that is because they were worried about the rugby league defence. Phil Lauder was the defence coach at the time. So they weren't sure how to defeat it on the ground. So they thought every time we get the ball, we're going to go for a drop goal. And that's how it came about. It was a reaction to England's defence because they were so afraid of it.
And if you can guarantee, or if you've got a 90% chance of getting 3 points every time you get to the 22, but if you go for a try, you've got a 20% chance of getting 7 points. Take the three.
Yeah. Well, if it's that easy, you just take the three all the time.
France, when they got to 12 points up, didn't take the three. And kick for the corner.
They did, didn't they?
Absolutely bonkers call. I mean, it paid off in the end, but...
Yeah, that was a bonkers call. That was mental, but brilliant. If it works, it works.
That 10 minutes was absolutely insane, that little comeback. And just an unbelievable attack. And, I mean, there was a couple of times where the commentators, I think even at the start, they sort of said, and it's almost like a phrase we've said all the time, or the French back line, if they click, they could be electric, but they're struggling to work out what the best combination is. Especially France forever.
Yeah, fast forward 20-something years. No, they could be electric, but if they just need to sort of get the right combination, yes, I think you know. And also, Le Maison was actually the backup. He wasn't due to play.
Just the game of his life.
What a game, eh?
Oh, the kickoffs were done at the start of each half, were kicked off as a place kick. And so, because they couldn't remove the kicking tee, which had now by this point moved to the basically the kickers used the cones that you use to mark out the pitch for training.
Yes.
Do you remember that period where there was none of these new kicking tees that people started using plastic cones? So a mound of sand, this was a relic of what used to be done before. And so the halves were kicked off with the ball on a mound of sand.
Well, I used to love seeing a mound of sand.
Yeah.
Sculpted.
So before that, no, sorry, after that became like the, basically like traffic cones.
That's the ones I'm talking about. The ones that you use at training now to mark.
Yeah. Oh no, there's one in between. So Stephen Larkin used to use them, and they were basically like 5 inches off the ground. They were massive.
They got banned, didn't they?
Yeah,
because people had these special kickoff tees that were. I think they were more than 5 inches off the ground.
They were huge.
They were like a foot and a half off the ground.
Rugby's equivalent of a pitching wedge.
Yeah. So you could boot it as high as you possibly could into the air. Then they got banned, and then I think they just went for the drop kick every time.
Did you ever play rugby at any point before they introduced the mounds of sand at the professional level, when the fly halves or fullback or whoever it was kicking would just dig up a grass divot in the ground and then shove the ball on top?
I remember being a kid when that was done.
Yeah, I played a game of rugby against one other guy, right? And we played this game for like 40 minutes after a game session in school. And basically, it was me versus Jonathan Belford. And if you scored the try, you got the kick, and then you got to get the ball again and then try and score a try. And anyway, this kid must have scored about 40 tries against me and got to attempt at least 40 kicks. I remember this because I had one kick, which I had to make the little divot out of. So, yeah, I remember that well, actually.
I wish I'd had some Hovis music to play over that.
No. Jay, you mentioned defence coaches before.
Yeah.
And that, so one of the things that I noticed in this game, particularly with New Zealand, actually, was just how poor their defensive line was. At all times, the defensive line, the back line from line-outs, from scrums, it was like there was no strategy, no cohesiveness. They didn't all know what to do. They'd all generally run in the direction of the ball at various different speeds, at various different times, from various different starting points. Yeah. It was crazy.
Various different calls.
Yeah. It was so weird. So some of the stuff in this game looked like modern day. Some of the stuff, the defensive patterns, was miles away.
Yeah, I wonder if it kind of shows you the opportunity cost and also the lack of resources for a coach. There's a great interview, and I should give the podcast that did it credit. I can't remember who it is, and I apologise to those podcasters. But they interviewed Stuart Lancaster, and one of the questions I asked him was, as a coach, is it important for you to know, he used to do everything, because Stuart Lancaster has been defence coach, attack coach, he's done a lot. Or do you want to be more of a generalist? And Stuart said, a bit more of a generalist, but there is an advantage of having just a defensive coach, because if you win the game and everyone's happy, but the defence didn't do too well, you might let yourself off. But if you're a defence coach, all you're focused on is the defence, and that error and those errors won't be papered over. And I wonder if what you were seeing in that New Zealand game was the effect of only having limited coaching resources, just making sure that let's just do lineouts and attack, because that's what we're good at.
And if you're winning games, which New Zealand more often than not are doing, you don't need to worry about it.
And I think what you pointed out, Phil, professionalism had only been there for 3 years by this point, so. Yes. The game hadn't moved too far from that. It was still, it had moved a long way in some respects. But in terms of this is the development through the next 4 years up to the 2003 World Cup was that the defence was chalk and cheese between the 1999 World Cup and the 2003 World Cup.
And I think if you watched the 2003 World Cup after watching this, I think the shift, the progression from 99 to 2003 would be greater than the progression between any other two World Cups, because the professionalism really hit home in between those two World Cups, which was led by England and Clive Woodward. Yeah.
Well, there's that story that Clive Woodward got in sort of about 2001, I think it was. It got in a changing room after a training one day, said to Josh Lucy, he was just about to get in the shower or something, right, Josh, stop. Everyone stop what you're doing. Got a chair, got Josh Lucy to stand on a chair, like with just his pants on or something. That is a professional athlete.
Wonder what Jason Leonard's reaction to that was.
Because that, I mean, it just puts in perspective what Jason Leonard managed to do from being in that 91 World Cup that you mentioned. He was there in that, and then right through to the 03 World Cup.
Yeah.
Amateur to professional.
Yeah.
And in World Cup peak, finals. Yeah.
To the absolute peak of professionalism. Yeah. That is impressive.
Right. I think we've done this game now.
Yeah, I'll just read a few little comments that we've
Please
had
do.
In. So Damien Stewart said he was at that match that day, remembers it well. He remembers the lovely French lady on the train back into London who still has his scarf. The game reminds him of what a legend Lomu is, he is a legend. Yeah. Walter Ludwig III, our esteemed friend that I mentioned earlier, he said he watched it with his seven-year-old son, whose three queries after watching were, why can't you laugh at the hacker? Which I thought JB would like.
Yep, I do.
Why aren't they penalising high tackles?
Yep.
And it blew his mind that he was watching Roman and Tomac's dad play.
Yeah. Who was actually very quiet in the game.
He was. Fabien Galthié, a hard, hard man. He smashed Lomu a couple of times. He was one of the few players actually was like going, yeah, I'll have this. I'll take him.
Yeah, and Galthié was another one who was, he was there in 2001 and he was still playing in, he was there in 1991 and was still playing in 2003. Because I think that's he won World Rugby Player of the Year in about 2001 or 2002.
Yeah. Lots of people mentioned Christian Cullen, who, there was a vote on some website or some blog or something this week, and Christian Cullen was voted the best fullback of all time.
Oh, okay. He's right up there for me. He never had the longevity of.
That's kind of what I was going to say. He was a fleeting brilliance.
Yeah,
he wasn't great at Munster.
Yeah, he had maybe 5-6 years of being unbelievable.
You don't see him kind of in the same way that Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin don't really give any interviews anytime, and they did some amazing things by, you know. I mean, it might trump playing a few rugby games that they walked on the surface of the moon, but...
Yeah, I don't know. They never played in a World Cup, did they?
But I can't remember ever seeing an interview with Christian Cullen post-playing career.
No.
I don't think I've ever heard him speak. I wonder what he does. I'm basically like a sheep farmer or pilot.
No. I don't know. I wonder if he does some stuff just purely in New Zealand. But I can't remember seeing him speak at all.
Tim Grant just said, thank you for doing this, boys. I normally watch the Sunday Premiership game whilst cooking the family meal. Was feeling a bit lost. This was spot on. What would you get for some of the high tackles that you see in that game?
Oh my God.
A lot of red cards. That is simply
a prison sentence, probably.
and this one from Darren Thompson said...
What?
Great to see some proper ruck justice. I agree with that. He also said Lomu's first half try was better than the try he is so famously remembered for. The game he scored against, the try he scored against England where he ran over Mike Catt.
Probably yes. Yeah. Just because of the sheer number of bodies around him.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just looking at this. Apparently Christian Cullen went back to New Zealand to start a business. Of which I do not know what the business is.
Good info.
I think we've done a pretty comprehensive job on that. I really enjoyed watching that game. If there's any more comments and stuff to filter in, then I'll just remind you of that email again, contactdegchasers@gmail.com. And I guess the only thing we've got left to do today is to pick the game for next week.
I think Northampton-Leinster, European Cup final.
In 2011.
One of my favourite games.
if you can find a full...
It is. It's there. I've already checked.
Is the full game there? Okay.
Full game.
I'll throw in some...
Go on.
I'll throw in a contender. Have you got one to think of? We can settle on an answer. Have you got one you fancy, Phil?
I would quite like to watch Wales versus Fiji from 2007 World Cup.
No, I'm not keen on that.
That was a fun. That was a hell of a game.
Yeah. What's yours, Tim?
So I'm just going to put a bunch of ones on the. I'll go with one of your picks for today, but. I'm just going to pin some to the notice board for future reference. We've had Sam Wiltshire suggesting... Flood hit on Twitter suggesting Tigers v Stade Francais Heineken Cup Final 2001.
Okay, yeah.
Bill McLaren on comms, Austin Healy and Andy Good pre-weave.
Nice.
England 26 all v New Zealand at Old Trafford. When Richard Cockerell squared up to Norm Hewitt during the Hacker.
Right.
What other ones have I got?
Boys!
Go on.
I've completely forgotten. I can't believe I've forgotten this. I've literally got a cup here. And what I've done is I've put all of the... I put a load of dates into the cup. And I've just basically said, why don't we just pick one out and do a Premier... A Premiership final?
Can do.
I want to pick a great game that we know we're going to love watching.
Okay. Either or.
I mean, I'm very happy going for the Leicester-Northampton Heineken Cup for this week because that's a hell of a game.
That comeback, wasn't it? Oh,
yeah.
Let's do that. Let me just chuck some other games just for future reference. And maybe if there's any of these that jump out and you really want to hear them, at Rugby Podcast on Twitter or whatever. In 2011, Six Nations, Italy 22, France 21. The goal line stand game I thought about, even though it wasn't high scoring or anything, it was just the Wales-Ireland. Australia v New Zealand in the year 2000, the Sydney game, 35-34.
Yeah, that's supposed to be one of the all-time best games.
We've got to do that at some point in the future because that was a bonkers game. New Zealand went 24-0 up, then it was 24-all at half-time. And then Sterling Mortlock scored the winning try or something.
Was he playing on the wing as well?
Yes. And do you know what the weak link was in that one again?
Lomu.
They targeted Lomu up in the air.
Interesting.
So Sterling Morlock is one wing. I'm sure Joe Roth is on the other one.
And then the other two on my little shortlist was Ireland v New Zealand in Chicago.
Yeah, yes, that's a good game.
Yeah, it's a great game.
And Japan v South Africa.
Yes, Japan v South Africa.
Oh. Yes.
We've got all sorts of eras and all sorts of games, but I'm happy to go with... Yeah, so give us a thought. If you've got any other suggestions... At Rugby Podcast on Twitter. But let's do that because that was an unbelievable game of rugby.
Yeah, let's do that.
Northampton, Leinster, 2000 and...
I think it's 11. I always get it wrong, though, I think.
Is there definitely a full game link?
Yeah, I'm sure there is. There definitely is. It's a full Sky Sports coverage.
Let's have a look.
Northampton, Leinster, 2011. There's 2013-14 full game.
I know this because I've watched it fairly recently.
Have you got a link to it?
I can't see a full game on YouTube, mate.
I can see a full game from...
2012.
Yeah. As well. Heineken Cup Final 2011. There's a 15-minute game.
I've got 2 hours and two here.
Have you?
Yeah.
Definitely the right match.
Daily Motion.
Not on YouTube.
Not on YouTube. It's on Daily Motion.
Cool.
Let's make sure this actually works before we ruin our... next week's podcast, but yeah, if that's the case, that's it. And I think we should draw next week. I quite like to draw just out a Premiership final at random.
All right. If me and Phil have a veto power, if it's a real stinker.
Yeah, obviously.
But also, I did just detail, we could alternate it. International club.
Yeah.
I'm game for that. So let's do club next week with this classic.
Can we not review like one of the worst games of all time? That's so much more fun.
Yes,
that would be quite fun.
Yeah, I think that would be fun actually.
Maybe not the worst game, like the most disappointing, like Wales on a Friday night scratching their way to a 12-9 win over Samoa.
I think there's something to be said for that. I can see that, but let's a few weeks of celebrating some great games. I'm just checking this link works.
Yeah, it does. I'm watching it now.
I'm watching a 32 minute ad break, which skips in 3, 2, 1, skip.
Yeah, I've got it here on the Daily Motion link.
It works.
Boom.
Ignore people who say your history does not matter.
Exactly.
Nice. Oh, we've moved on a long way in those 12 years. The quality of the TV broadcast.
Yes.
Yeah,
and the quality of the kits as well.
Can I say, Tim, I've fast-forwarded a bit on that thing. The quality of the pitch side reporting, garbage.
Was then.
Not like it is now, mate.
Not like it is now, obviously. Right, cool. Right, you know where to find us, at Rugby Podcast on Twitter. He's at Jay Beardmore. I'm at Cocker. Phil will let you know if he wants you to hear from him. He's lurking in the swamp. We're contactairchasers@gmail.com. Give us your thoughts on your homework for this week, which is Northampton versus Leinster in the 2011 Heineken Cup final, which is on Daily Motion, all 2 hours of the TV broadcast. Very much looking forward to getting stuck into that one. And I will just also flag up BT Sport, whilst they don't have live Premiership games, do have lunchtimes every single day this week, some retro Premiership games.
Wonderful stuff.
So do check that out as well. And World Rugby have an old school game every Saturday at 2:30 on their Facebook page.
Yeah.
Right, I think we're done, gents.
I think we are. Well done all.
Right, thank you very much. Hit subscribe and we'll see you on the next one.
Stay safe. Bye.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.